Jorge, thank you for that invitation or provocation to the role and purpose of what we're doing. I think you talked about the business of resilience as well as a global public good. And we are all incredibly privileged in this strange corner of finance that we work in to be able to do really serious business, but also possibly at the apex of cracking the biggest global challenge that we all face, whether we're in the rich north or the other parts of the world. So I thought it's great to be, and Jorge, thank you for coming and giving us that provocation, and Steve for arranging it. It's great to be on the panel here with Michael, also from the World Bank, Stephen Bennett from ICI, and Adern from Descartes. We're going to have a conversation in a minute. I thought the title of the show, or this part of the show, was very clever, but I expected nothing else from an ex-employee. The Future of Parametric Triggers in Cat Bonds and ILS. And I want it to really trigger a conversation, because the triggers are at the heart of this. And yes, we will have, I'm sure, a discussion about how improved technical triggers can improve the quality of what we do. It can improve and broaden the scope of what we do, even beyond, well beyond NatCat, of course. And it can improve the consistency and confidence that both investors as well as seasons have in our market. So, of course, we can do that. But there's actually a bigger point, because triggers that people understand are at the heart of actually the gearbox of what we're doing. And so to set the scene, what struck us in 99 when Artemis was underway was, and how things have progressed in the wider insurance and reinsurance market the last 20 years is, make no mistake, this sector and this group in this room is at the very apex of it, has done a remarkable thing. It has converted physics into finance. No other sector has done that. And it's done it through the challenge of also understanding and managing extremes. And the challenge for us, actually, frankly, is to take this incredible expertise and propagate it and translate it into a much larger role and marketplace. But it's been, frankly, a wee bit of a struggle. But the urgency and need to do that is going to be critical. And the development of triggers that people can understand and connect with and be part of their industry and their country and their world is going to be essential. But there's also one final observation that I wanted to share after almost a quarter of a century in this space. And the view that this revolution in a corner of finance would become much broader. And frankly, maybe it hasn't quite as expanded as much as we all wanted it to beyond its natural heartland of protecting insurance and reinsurance companies for their extreme risk. And I've pondered why that might be. And actually, Jorge, if I may, it's in a sense an issue of policy and regulation, because what drove this market in the 90s and the 2000s, as our market went from ruin to resilience, was the recognition that insurance companies would have to evaluate their contingent liabilities and prove to insurance regulators concerned about the validity of policies, as well as credit rating agencies concerned about the validity of investments, that they held capital that was sufficient, not for what had happened, but what could happen. And in reinsurance policy or parametric policy so essentially the market had to take, we didn't call it then, but we'll call it now, a climate medical. And every contingent capital policy that was bought, insurance or parametrics, could be held as a contingent asset on the balance sheet. So you got credit, literally, for the policy, whether the event or the event did not happen. And I think the challenge that we face, whether it's in sovereign risk or in more mainstream finance court risk, is we are beginning to see climate and natural catastrophe risk disclosure beyond insurance. But as yet, you don't have to actually really take the medical. You don't have to take the medicine. You don't need to actually hold a contingent capital against that liability. But that will happen. And when it does, and wider markets beyond insurance get the credit for the incredible revolution that we've enacted in our sector with improved technology and all the rest, And I think it's the next 10 years that we'll see that. So it's been a slow burn in a way. But I think the next climate decade is going to be the one that really probably moves us into a whole new zone. So with that, I'm going to ask our esteemed group. I'll give Michael a few minutes to ponder what Jorge said. Idern, start with you if I may, because
you know
Descartes is such a focal point of this. Where do you see the future of parametrics and triggers to then drive, obviously, demand for ILS?
So yeah, thanks for the invitation, Steve, and thanks, Rowan. So it's a pleasure to be here to discuss two of my favorite topics, so parametrics and ILS. So just a few words about Descartes. So Descartes is a global insurtech company specialized in parametric insurance. So it was created back in 2018 and has experienced rapid growth since then. We are 150 people today worldwide. With hubs in Europe, Americas, Asia, Oceania. In terms of business, Descartes is generating more than 100 million euro premium every year for their partners. I think that's it for Descartes. In terms of what is our day-to-day life at Descartes, it's quite different than ILS market overall. So we are receiving requests from brokers all over the globe to cover their clients. It could be a hotel in the Caribbean, for example, that wants to be covered against hurricane. Then what we do is we review the risk profile of the client to design the best structure for them. So it could be, for example, if a Cat 3 hurricane comes at less than X miles from the hotel, we trigger a payout. And then if the client validates the cover and the premium, it leads to our risk carrier are covering this client. So in terms of the variety of products that we have, it's quite broad. I can give a couple of examples to set where we are. So we have a lot of covers for renewable energies. So it could be a lack of wind cover for a wind farm, for example, if there is less wind than expected in a given year, we pay them an amount. Similarly, for solar farms, we have lack of solar radiation cover. Agriculture is a big topic also. We can cover them against frost. We can put a sensor directly within the fields to measure temperature. And if the temperature goes below a certain threshold, we pay them a fixed amount. For agriculture, we are also covering directly the yield of some fields in Africa, for example. So we try to detect the yield by satellite. And if the yield is lower than expected, we make a payment to the farmer or the countries. We also are covering the full suite of natural catastrophes. So, for example, earthquakes that can be covered similarly to the public cat bond based on USGS, for example. More recent trend is to install directly within buildings sensors, so ground shaking sensors. And if the acceleration detected is higher than a certain threshold, we make a payout directly to the client. It could be a big factory, for example, or big industrial companies. Flood covers could be another example. So if you have a building nearby a river, we can use gauge station to trigger a payment. So see if the water level exceeds a certain threshold on the river, the client instantly receives a payout. On the opposite, we have seen this problem recently that the water level could go too low. It could be on canals or river. And if you have a barge company that is just transporting goods from one point to the other through the river, it just cannot go through if the water level is too low. So we can cover them like this. So an interesting peril maybe in terms of trigger could be also wildfires. So wildfire, today the standard for parametric is to be covered by satellite. So it's easy from space to detect if something is burnt or not. So we can just pay the client if the satellite imagery shows that the area is burnt or the building is burnt. We are constantly trying to improve those products to be as close as possible to the client experience on the ground. Fortunately, there is some companies like ISAI that are helping us to do that and to have a more precise view of what could be the experience of the client on the ground.
Thank you so much. Please get your questions ready. We'll be moving to questions from the audience fairly soon after our initial. And I'm ruthless at just picking on people, so be careful, but particularly those I know. Over to you, Stephen.
Sure. Thanks very much. I'm Steve Lathrop from ISAI, and thanks for that mention, Adan. So I run the solutions team at ISAI. We're the part of the business that provides natural catastrophe insights and persistent asset monitoring solutions, specifically to the insurance industry and to the government sector. We are at our heart, we're a space tech company. We're a commercial organization, about 600 people now around the planet, who build and operate our own constellation of satellites. There's a model one out there by where we ate earlier. And we've launched about 25 of those spacecraft so far. We use the data from those spacecraft to help with resilience, event response, and risk. So I guess at one level, a space tech company might sound a little bit removed from ILS and some of the discussion that we've been having today. But I guess our contention is that there is a huge amount of increased diversity, volume, accuracy, timeliness of data out there, and it has the potential to really transform the types of triggers that can be used in parametric insurance and in the ILS cat bond sector. And that's what we're about. Just to give a flavour of the kind of insights that we can provide, we have a live flood product and a live wildfire product. We've analysed about 120 flood events so far around the world. And when we report within about 24 hours of an event, we give a depth of water report at a 3 metre by 3 metre pixel level, and we can associate that with individual buildings and do so really quickly. For wildfire, we can detect, as Adan said, you can see where the burning has happened. The product that we launched recently in the US for wildfire, in Australia for bushfire, is actually detecting very rapidly, while the fire is still burning, which buildings have been destroyed. With a very high level of accuracy, and well before you can get aircraft, drones, or other devices into the area. The technology at the heart of what we do, at risk of sounding like some of that applied physics, Rohan, my job is to protect people from applied physics rather than drag them through it, but the technology is something called synthetic aperture radar, which has been around supporting the insurance industry for a long time. But what makes this new space is that we have miniaturized the device that does the detection, the radar device, and we've miniaturized the satellites, which is why the whole thing's become a lot cheaper and why we've been able to create the world's largest constellation. That means more data and the ability to detect things, as I said, more rapidly. So lots of potential for triggers and for this conversation. Right.
Super. Thank you for triggering that conversation further. Michael.
I'm ready to go. Thanks, Steve, for inviting me, and Jorge as well. Our cat bond and reinsurance business has been built on parametric triggers. That's because of the nature of our clients. They're looking at this market largely for immediate liquidity after a disaster, so they can't wait a long time for loss adjustment. And frankly, a lot of them don't even have those kind of losses. A lot of our clients are ministries of finance. And after a large event occurs, they need to rebalance their budgets and take money from different areas. And it's very difficult to put that in a classic excess loss sort of calculation. So parametrics have really been critical to everything we do. we would love to see all of these developments, and they're all really exciting, help us in our member countries, because a lot of places are quite difficult where we're doing work. And we're also doing this largely for the sovereign government. And if you talk about things like floods and droughts, that maybe traditionally have relied on ground sensors, which are often government-managed sensors, you have an automatic conflict of interest. So whether that's a conflict so large it would make a deal impossible, I wouldn't say, but there's definitely a conflict that could be eliminated or mitigated by the use of things like satellite technology. So it's certainly very, very exciting. The place where I have not seen it be able to be applied, or the reason I haven't seen it really be able to apply it, is because, of course, we need modeling that ILS investors will accept, because we're talking for a sovereign government about fairly large amounts of insurance, and our typical size transaction is probably $250-300 million, but we've done quite a bit larger than that. So we need significant capacity, which means translates into multiple risk takers, which translates into the need for easily recognized models that are recognized. And frankly, that in our experience has translated even beyond the need for ILS type modeling to frankly the need for RMS or AIR often. Because universally, when I talk to ILS investors and ask, would you take a model by someone other than, and I might even mention the firm, they will say yes. I've never had an ILS investor tell me no, I couldn't take a model from them. They all say yes. We do our own modeling, we have our own scientists, not a problem. But then dig a little deeper, and often they say, well, of course, you know, the multiple would have to go up because there's uncertainty, you know, we don't know this modeling firm, there'd be uncertainty. So if the multiple is going to go up so much, then it can destroy the rationale for the transaction, and it becomes cheaper for us to hire RMS or AR to build a model, frankly. So I think, and that, I mean, for RMS and AR, I'm sure are here, and that's great. You know, congratulations, your business is really going well in the ILS market, I think. But I'd be interested to know really how practically, for large size transactions, we can use some of these technologies, and whether when you're talking about the cover you're writing, kind of what size is that, and how scalable do you think that sort of cover is for these technologies? So,
I guess. Thank you so much, Michael and Adana, Steve. And I just want to unpack a couple of those comments and then hopefully open it up to the floor, because I can see everyone getting more and more interested with every passing comment. So let's assume that the right sort of triggers are the key to unlocking growth and demand in the marketplace and obviously improving quality. So I guess there's three dimensions through which parametrics can improve. So, Edern, perhaps, I'll ask three questions and you can each pick, but Edern, perhaps for you, this one. Do you sit there in your, I'm going to call it underwriting cockpit,
yeah,
and say, if only I had a parametric measurement that could do X for Y, I would be able to underwrite or protect this whole new area or improve, whether it's in ag or whatever. I mean, so I'm talking about literally the existence of new or evolving parametric scope. The second dimension, and is that what really focuses your attention, or is it not really? I mean, yeah, some new things come along, great, but there's plenty out there already. The second restriction, perhaps, and you hinted at it, Michael, if I may, is geographical scope. If only we had the same quality of flood data in country X as we have in country Y, we could do A, B, and C. So it's really a question of scope as opposed to sort of range. But then you've touched on a final point, Michael, which I guess is the plumbing in the marketplace. Because if I interpreted you correctly, it's basically, you know what? You can have the best science, you can have the best specialist modeling, but unless it gets into one or two gearboxes, which are effectively the Microsoft Word or Excel of the marketplace, the medium through which everyone communicates, unless it actually gets into that system, frankly, and with no criticism to researchers in the audience, it might as well be an academic paper sitting on a shelf somewhere, because it's not actually going to get into the gearbox. And that's a sort of third issue about, actually, there's so much pent-up potential, but it's all about what gets through that very important and well, and that's why they're so successful, high-quality valve of information to key models in the marketplace. So I suppose my real question is, Adern first, you know, what are your dreams? Well, to actually unlock the potential of what this market has through the parametric trigger.
Sure, but I think what you need to have is to have a trigger that the clients think will pay when they want it to pay.
Yeah.
So today, for example, for severe convective storm, like hail storms, so we have very good radar data in the US
mm-hmm.
that we can use to detect the hail size and the impact of a big hail storm over a certain area. This is not available worldwide, for sure. Even in Europe, so you have some radar data, but if I take my home country, France, if you want to buy this data to have historical records, today it's €200,000 just for 1 year. Mm-hmm. So it's really, if those data were available, we could propose a parametric cover for hail in France at a global scale. Today, we have to limit ourselves where the data is available. So one of my dreams would be that the data is made, at least by public agency, is made public. I think today the World Bank, for example, you are using USGS or NHC, which are public US entity. Unfortunately, they provide this data for free, which is helps to build those contracts. So yeah, my first dream would be data globally available, and then starting from there, we can design structures specifically for entities that want to be covered. If I want to take the question of Michael on the size, so our typical transaction range from 5 million limit to 300 million limits. So this is typically the size you see in the market, even for corporates. You have some big corporates, for example, in the Caribbean, that have networks that can be completely wiped out by a hurricane. They are buying 200, 300 millions of limits.
Yeah.
So this is I think today the ILS market is mainly focused on reinsurance and retrocession. But there is a big part out there that is a step before, which is insurance, which is quite much bigger.
Sure. So your key issue is really about data accessibility in the broader sense,
yeah.
as well as obviously significant quality to ensure that people are confident that it's going to meet their needs. Mm. I'm going to come to you, sure. Lars, if I may, Stephen, but Michael, anything you want to sort of...
Well, maybe just one specific example of how this can hit me. I had a boss before Jorge. I had the benefit of not getting promoted, so I keep working on cat bonds and my bosses keep changing. But I had an earlier boss before Jorge. I had an early boss before Jorge who met maybe at a conference, maybe at a cocktail party, some physicist who was working on studying beehive behavior and linking beehive behavior to different temperature changes, which in turn could suggest crops failing or crops doing better. And I guess it was I'm sure it was fascinating, you know, incredible work. But then my boss asked me, well, why we should do a transaction based on that, right? We should be able to, you know, do a ILS transaction based on, you know, beehive behavior. You know, we had to, of course, try, and it turned out, you know, ILS investors were skeptical. But, I mean, that's an extreme example, but these new technologies, we would love to use these new technologies, right? I mean, there are places where, you know, there are no, you know, I talked about the conflict of interest of sensors, there's a place where there's no sensors at all, and where satellite... ISI technology would be fantastic. But exactly, it's got to be translated into something that you folks will accept. And that's in size. And that has been the trick. And I think it's I don't say that pessimistically. I think it's coming, but it definitely is. There's a leap there, to put it in your terms, Rowan, into the right toolkit or toolbox to work for large numbers of ILS investors. And I'd love to hear more from my co-panelists and the audience about how they see that happening.
Well, you're at the heart of this challenge.
Sure. I mean, if I can respond to that, what's your dream? And also link to... I guess my dream is that, you know, the question that Michael teed up a minute ago about, you know, how can we... for some of these bigger transactions, move away from having to go back to the same model based on the same triggers. And we see actually quite a lot of adoption of new technologies and new triggers, but just not on that sort of scale of transaction. So, you know, we're very proud to be involved working with Descartes, working with other innovators like Global Parametrics, and being involved in some of the IDF arrangements such as Ghana, where we provide a trigger for flooding in Accra when it happens. So we're watching Accra quite carefully. And there is a scheme in place that will pay out to that vulnerable community in that city. Same is true in Lagos. Same is true in New York City, which was something arranged with Guy Carpenter and our customer Swiss Re. So, you know, there is innovation there that is using a wholly different way of measuring what's happening on the ground. They're all flood related. We expect to be able to provide a wind damage report by the end of this year. We'll move on to earthquake and tsunami, which we're doing R&D with our customer Tokyo Marine down in Japan right now. And, you know, we see adoption and we see innovation around the market, including folks in this room. When it gets up to some of those bigger transactions, it's, you know, we seem to default to, you know, what's been done before and find it a little bit harder to apply some of this new stuff. So that's my dream, would be for that sort of innovation and adoption of this new stuff to proliferate and go a little bit up and out into some of those bigger opportunities to, you know, protect communities, essentially.
Sure. Well, we've got 20 minutes or so, maybe a little bit longer if we're lucky, and would love to now trigger the wider conversation. In the middle of the room. Yes. Is there a microphone?
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
That's my job.
Oh.
Yeah, thanks for that fascinating discussion. So, Rowan, I think I blinked first because I was probably expecting you to pick me in the conversation. But I think I want to start off by being a little bit provocative. Mm. So I want to reword what I think the title should be. So it should be the use of parametric triggers in reducing the protection gap in future. Because parametric triggers are already established within ILS. You know, as part of, you know, they were already established. But what we're really talking about in terms of the dream or the question that we're putting to members of the panel is around how can we use parametric triggers to reduce the protection gap. And that's really where the opportunity lies for a lot of people within this room. But I also wanted just to highlight a few points in terms of the imbalance in terms of the production gap and where the models and data actually are, or what the focus is. So the comment that Michael made around use of AIR and, you know, in terms of, you know, them being the most readily acceptable models, if you then overlay that with where the insurance is mostly needed, there are no models, or there are very few models, and there's a very short, or there's data quality issues. So part of the conversation should be, how do we get the right models or acceptable models in the places where insurance is needed most, so that we don't then actually impute an additional cost on the people who need the insurance the most, because as soon as the model that's being used in a transaction is not one that's, you know, well known, there's going to be a risk premium. So I just wanted to pose that to the panel. Thank you.
Well, I wonder if I could pick up on a question there, because, of course, you at African Risk Capacity have played a critical role in helping to drive African risk view and the understanding of risk across Africa. Is from your perspective, what is the limiting factor? Is it the fact that modeling cannot be effectively consumed by risk takers. So countries feel comfortable that this represents their risk, but obviously then there's a translation system of how it gets into the gearbox of the relevant risk capital markets. And is that the nub of the issue from your experience?
Yeah, so I think I would say yes and no. I would say no because one of the panelists there from Descartes, you know, they're reinsurers, and we've had reinsurers such as Swiss Re, Score, you know, other. So our model is well accepted within the markets. We've transferred over $1 billion of risk in the last 10 years or so. But then when we want to move from the traditional reinsurance structure to ILS, then of course the bar is a little bit higher. Mm-hmm. So that's where the issues around the model and the data start coming in.
Sure.
So that's why I would say sort of yes and no. But also I just feel that the primary question here, which is also what Jorge also hinted, was around how do we address, you know, the key issues when you look at climate change and also the people who are going to get impacted by climate change being the least capable of being responding. So how do we reposition the discussion and also make it into a discussion where the players within this room can actually benefit by providing public goods, by marrying, essentially making sure that the incentives are there, the systems are there, the models are there, and the data is there, so that, you know, it can be in a wholly beneficial structure or discussion.
Complete ecosystem. Anybody else like to ask questions or make any observations? Anyone behind me? Seems okay. Well, let's come back to the group. But please, it's a unique opportunity for us to have a conversation about how to actually confront a really pressing global challenge, which is at the heart of our business. And we've all spent a lot of carbon and a lot of money to get here together. And we all suffer from the imposter syndrome, thinking, well, we don't know enough about this to make a comment. We all suffer that. But unless we can ventilate the realities so that our friends at the World Bank can understand the real issues in the market, or our analytical friends can understand, we won't make the progress we all want to as businesses, and certainly we won't crack this grand challenge that we've just, you know, had motivating. So, but to anyone who wants to make some intermediate questions, but would love to just raise any issues. I mean, you may say this is all rubbish. You know, we're all fine. We just need more premium to be spent by the right sort of organisations, and everything's great, and we've got to figure out how to mobilise premium. That's a separate matter. But let's keep on the analysis.
Maybe just one reaction to that. I think it's a great observation. And I started my comment saying that at the World Bank, because we're dealing with sovereign government clients, where parametric really is the right trigger solution. When you get down to broader protection gap issues, things like how do we cover small farmers against drought risk, that's where I get worried about parametric triggers, because there is obviously a lot of basis risk embedded in parametric triggers. And I tell anyone who joins my team that this is a job for the courageous, because in an international government organization, that basis risk is really a scary thing. And what I'm talking about is obviously, you know, a big event occurs and it just misses the parameters. And everyone says, I thought you insured Jamaica. And we say, well, no, we insured them only for, you know, this central pressure hurricane, not this other central pressure hurricane. So I would really worry about that sometimes when people try to apply parametric triggers down to farming cooperatives and things, because I think there's very low tolerance, and there should be very low tolerance for negative basis risk situations there. I think a lot of that really, I mean, I don't know who invented insurance, probably Italians 500 years ago. Whoever invented insurance, I think, had a pretty good idea to cover actual losses. It's only, you know, we tend to use parametrics when we have to, when we're insuring governments. I don't think parametrics is always going to be a protection gap solution.
Can I challenge that a little, Michael? So I understand and agree completely about the basis risk, but I think what I would encourage everybody to do is to look at the kind of data that is available very rapidly you know, during and after events nowadays, and actually some of the sort of predictive analytics that's available as well. Because I understand, you know, when people are putting together, and this is a, you know, this is a question based on limited understanding actually of cat bonds, but you know, you can go either wait and find out what the actual cost was and use that indemnity basis, or you go parametric, and the assumption is that if you go on the parametric side, you assume a load more basis risk, there's less correlation with the actual loss, but you can do something quickly, and that gets help out to people fast. So if I just take wind as an example, you know, what we are working on and expect to release later this year for wind is not is a count of the buildings that have been destroyed available within sort of 12, 24 hours of the wind rushing through. So that isn't a measurement of the wind and then a model saying how much damage might happen from a wind that looked like that at that point in time over there. It's how many buildings have gone 12 to 24 hours after an event's washed through. What should that trigger? And I think some of the technologies are capable of getting much, much closer to the actual loss without waiting for the claims experience to develop over X years.
Would you call that a parametric trigger? I would almost think of that more as just a speedy indemnity trigger that's based on something other than traditional loss adjustment.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we've been talking about it as a bit of a hybrid in as much as it's not waiting for the claims cost. I'm saying, you know, Jamaica, something bad has happened. 50% of the buildings have gone. We can tell you that now. That's a parameter in my view. It might be getting you closer to a modelling of the loss, which might take you more to indemnity, but it's a distance away from a model that is based on how strong was the wind. And I think that there are lots of challenging technologies out there, be they from space or be they sensors around the patch, that can just help us to be parametric in the way that this stuff can be applied and the pace and what that can mean for communities that have suffered and need to recover, but that are closer to the actual cost of what's happened and that should be, if people could get their heads into modelling it, which is part of my dream, should be able to then make it kind of more affordable.
Thanks so much. A few people have caught my eye, so we'll go to, and name an affiliation first. We'll go Clive first, and then I think Michael. There's a gentleman over there in the white shirt, so we'll go 1, 2, 3. I'm conscious, I must say, that the voices have not been very gender diverse so far on this panel. So I will be particularly keen on a diversity of voices, if I can, after those three. But Clive, over to you. We'll take all three, then we'll come to the panel, then we'll hear some ladies from the audience as well.
Clive O'Connell, McCarthy Denning, among other places. One answer to the basis risk issue, surely, is embedded parametrics. That is that people are buying insurance without knowing they're buying insurance, and therefore they don't have any issue when a claim isn't paid. They're just overjoyed when a claim is paid. And that gets over and also a fundamental issue, and that is that people, generally speaking, don't want to buy insurance. If you're very poor, the last thing you don't want to do is spend a few cents buying an insurance policy. You've got other things that are your priorities immediately. You're not looking into the future when the disaster happens. But a bottom-down approach is surely essential if you want to get money to the people who really need it and don't want the frictional operations of governments and other people to siphon off that money on the way down to the people who need it. You get money to the people who need it immediately after a disaster, and therefore help them on a microeconomic basis, but also macroeconomically help the area that has been devastated by disaster by getting lots of cash in there.
Thank you. I think we're going to come to Michael next, and then we'll go to the back on this side.
Thank you, Steve. I'll stand. Well, first of all, Michael, the insurance was invented in Babylon about 1750 BC. So just brought that for you. What I wanted to say, if I may, to the panel and friends around this room, was simply you described the most fantastic opportunity, as we've all shared it, and we've all been frustrated by perhaps the scope and scale, both of which are broadening and increasing, respectively. And so the opportunity is immense. What we haven't really discussed is the point, Rowan, you just touched on the expression mobilized premium. That was just an expression. But in other words, somebody's got to pay the premium if this is to broaden in scope and increase in scale. And that, of course, comes back to governments. And what we haven't discussed is how we convince our respective governments, whether they be here, of course, or in the United States, Germany, Australia, the obvious ones, how we encourage ministries of finance to support the sort of initiatives that you can wholesale the product, which is what you've described. And we and the people in this room are more than capable of delivering it, and the analysis, and as you also said, Stephen. So I suppose what I wanted to introduce was perhaps a question of how we know what we're talking about, but how do we bring the public along who've got to spend the money, and that is the respective ministers of finance. And you know, we're talking to ministers in the UK and have done for years. They get it, but they don't write the checks. And that's what we need to mobilise.
Thank you, Michael. We'll take the third question and then we'll take a pause.
Hiya, Tim Akosh, CEO of Yukahu. Just really to raise with the panel or for their thoughts on particularly focusing on the difference between ILS and, say, parametric insurance, the opportunity that, Edern, you mentioned, like, the insurance space. And in our experience of developing products, it's less about the peril and really having to get really specific on the risk. So trying to not focus very heavily on the traditional parameter, but the actual outcome for the event, that's what people care about, right? And Stephen, yeah, I completely agree with you in terms of it's still parametric if we're taking observed changes, you know, in imagery or whatever, and making a decision, right? And I think that plays a role in the property casualty space going forward, definitely. So I guess in terms of my question, it's like, how can we close that gap? Because there's definitely a difference in language between me knowing very little about the ILS market, being here trying to learn that, and what I'm seeing on the front end, and how do we go about translating that and getting that across in the ILS products in terms of the benefits of the overall insurance product that's bringing the capital or bringing the opportunity to the capital markets.
Thank you so much. I don't want to come back on any one of those three comments at all. Edern, perhaps to kick off with.
Yeah, on the question on government, I think it's more for Michael. Yeah. On the last point, so how to bring to ILS the product, I think we can already do that today. So there is multiple possibilities to do it. We can do it through, it could be done through cat bonds. We have seen a couple of examples, I think, for mortgage company in California. I think it was Blackstone who had a cat bond recently. And there was another one called Sierra, I think. So it's possible to issue public cat bonds. So this is a possibility. But where I see the main growth is private deals. So I think today, when I discuss with people in the industry, they are able to model the products that we do, especially when it comes to hurricanes and earthquakes. The models are there, and it's quite easy for them to do. Of course, you need to spend time with them to explain what is the product, etc. But I think in the end, it's possible today to bring this insurance deals to the ILS marketplace through private deals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just on private versus governments and public, I mean, I guess we are seeing a lot of openness to use of the new data and for new triggers on in private deals. I do feel like there's real opportunity for positivity around some of what is happening in the public sector. So those arrangements through the IDF that I mentioned, where those are private and public, if you like, they're collaborations and they are relatively small scale, some of them at the moment, quite focused, but I think they will blaze a trail. And they will demonstrate, you know, what's possible, and get more and more attention as, communities around the world become more aware of the fact that all of these catastrophes are going to continue to increase in severity and frequency, and they are going to need protection. And some of it is almost embedded, because these arrangements are being put in place by people who care about those vulnerable communities. So I think there are signs of hope in that. It's just about, you know, how do we accelerate some of that? How do we accelerate the awareness of what the art of the possible is in measuring stuff quick in order to provide a trigger, whatever measurement that is, and then apply it to, you know, something that enables you to price as well, as you were saying earlier, Michael.
Great. Any more questions? If I may, particularly from any ladies in the audience. Yes, a lady right at the back in a blue jacket. I thought I saw your hand going up. Sorry, I can't recognize. So name and affiliation.
I'm going to take one for the team on the ladies' side.
Thank you.
I actually had a comment in addition to what Stephen was saying. I'm with ISAI as well, and just wanted to add the perspective that we had a lot of success in big commercial and the industrial segment as well, where we had a lot of where there's more premium in the game and you can play around with the triggers. There's new data on a very granular scale the way it wasn't available before. So I just wanted to add that aspect to like play a bit on a different ground as compared to going to a whole community, trying to do the years of exercise on convincing a whole political engine in a country that's really not yet accustomed to working with the industry at all. So no question, sorry, but a comment.
Maybe we're just on the government point, if I could. I mean, it's definitely compelling for any, let's say, rich world government to pay for insurance of poor neighbors, because essentially they are insuring their own aid budgets, right? When you have, if you have a small South Pacific country has a major event, I'm sure Australia and New Zealand will, in every case, come to their aid. It's a compelling argument, and it is definitely happening, too. We're seeing much more willingness of developed countries to provide assistance for premium payments. And our Jamaica transaction that Jorge mentioned, that was fully paid, the premiums were fully paid by donors. It was the U.S., Germany, and England, basically, were the suppliers of premium for $185 million of coverage, so fairly significant. It's always going to be a bit scary, I think, for a government to provide assistance for premiums because of the risk that you've paid for something. And when it's audited in 3 years, if it didn't trigger, you know, you have to say the money went out, but we didn't get anything back. So I think it takes a while for governments to understand that. But it's definitely happening, and I think we're going to see more, much more of that, because really it is insuring their own aid budgets.
I must say, I want to pick up on that one. As some know, I've just joined Howden, and it's great to be here with Mitchell and Stuart and Philip and the team. And certainly one area that we're going to really focus on is how to project the parametric, and obviously within that ILS opportunity within the mainstream climate space. And I see there's two particular challenges and opportunities which have highlighted. So Jorge earlier talked about public goods, and it was a pleasure to have Jorge around the Insurance Development Forum Steering Group table, which was kindly hosted at the World Bank. And one of those public goods is absolutely around risk data, and there's some very important initiatives, not least the Global Resilience Index, seeking to provide that core reference data on risk, not just hazard, on risk that can hopefully ultimately then also find its way into the transaction gearbox. And without that, you know, we're all flying blind. Until there's a standard reference for sovereign climate natural disaster risks, which is factored into ultimately credit risk and sovereign debt, it doesn't count. But the other one I would say, if I may, Jorge, with you in the room, and perhaps obviously Michael chip in, is it's around incentives. So if one provides at a sovereign level serious contingent protection for, you know, the driving risks and perils for that economy, whether it's funded by the country or funded by the Global North through the Global Shield or whatever it might be, I at the moment with particular exceptions where there's been an issue, for example, in Belize, where it's all tied in with the issue of the one, but I don't think that the countries properly get the credit for that contingent capital that they now have. And ultimately, the beneficiaries of that are the wider investors. I'm not talking about the World Bank, the wider investors, the wider markets, even actually, yes, global north countries who will have a moral imperative to respond if a disaster occurs. And until there's the recognition by those who are ultimately benefiting from that reduction in financial exposure, then there isn't really the incentive that there should be for countries or anyone else to... And I wonder whether this is something that has been discussed. I mean, ultimately, it would be wonderful to think that if you issued the right cap bonds for a country, it would, by norm, have an appropriate and proportionate impact on the credit risk and rating of that country. That isn't happening yet. And that seems suboptimal. And I just wonder, perhaps, within the public finances, I mean, isn't my specialist field. I wonder if that's already beginning to happen.
It's starting to happen. And when shortly after we did the Jamaica transaction, Fitch put out a credit report on Jamaica, on their sovereign credit, saying this was a significant positive for their sovereign credit rating. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, particularly because the coverage was, when you look at coverage to GDP, so in other words, in Jamaica's case, the coverage to GDP was much higher number than most of the transactions we've done for much bigger countries that obviously have much, much larger GDP. So it's, I think it's starting to happen. It's certainly something we always ask the rating agencies about. But I think you're exactly right. It really should.
I mean,
it should be immediately credit positive.
Reduce the borrowing costs, increase fiscal space, and that's where it should get to. So we've got 5 minutes left. Had the nod from Steve. Probably time for one more question, either gender or anything in between, and we'll have final comments from the panel. So any final questions or observations? Okay, let's go. We'll start with Michael this time and end with Steve.
I think combined with Jorge, I maybe have spoken enough, so why don't I let give my time to... I yield my time.
Oh, to me? Right, okay. I guess I liked your question, Rowan, which is what is your dream to each of us? And I think we've expressed, dreams that relate to our involvement currently. I think all of it comes together. I think the gentleman's comment there about how does what we're talking about in the room today really start to benefit people in parts of the world that are heavily exposed to some of these catastrophic events, where we're talking about those, and what can we all collectively do? And I think we've heard some views expressed around the room about ways in which to do that. I think that's a fantastic kind of common good focus for bringing the creativity in the ILS sector together with, dare I say it, applied physics. I'm 55, I work for a 34-year-old electronic engineer, which is absolutely exhausting. But they are bursting with ways of detecting stuff that's changing. And when we're bringing that data to the marketplace and saying to organizations like those in this room, how do we apply it? How do we make this work to make communities more resilient in places where resilience is important but maybe not quite so affordable, I think that's a great purpose for us all to share, and one that we're pretty excited about, and we see lots of reasons to be encouraged.
Fantastic.
I would say.
I think that was a good conclusion.
It was. Ultimately we are delivering the ultimate community product. That's what we do, risk sharing and related governance. So it's been a fabulous panel. Thank you all so much for your contributions. Thanks to the audience for your interventions, and Steve for bringing us all together.